Greetings of peace. Welcome to the Dean Show. We have our next guest, terrorist expert, columnist, journalist, CJ Wheelerman. No stranger to the show. Coming up, we're going to be bringing you up to speed on some of the current events that are happening out there in the world. India, China, Bosnia, and right here at home. And this hopefully can awaken some of the good hearts that are out there to go ahead and create more awareness so we can make a good change for the better. God willing, we'll be right back with our special guest. Don't go anywhere. This is the Dean Show. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Dean Show. We have no stranger to the show, CJ Wheelerman, journalist, columnist for Middle East Eye, author of The New Atheist Threat. How are you, CJ?
Good, mate. How are you doing?
Great to have you back on the program. How have you been?
Good. I've been very well. Thank you for having me back in your program. I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you for finding the time. Let's get right into it. How have things been since the last time we spoke on the rise of any hate attacks, Islamophobia? You're monitoring most of this. How is it going since the last time? I think it's almost been a year. Has it decreased, increased? What's the situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly increasing. I mean, there's been a spike in hate crimes. If you trace back to the Brexit vote, trace back to Trump's election, if you use those two points as a marker in time, the number of hate crimes against Muslims in the UK, in Europe, in the United States, and Australia has increased precipitously. I mean, we're living in a climate of hate and fear. I just actually had a piece come out for TRT World a couple of days ago, which examines and reveals how Russia now is mobilizing and trying to unite, internationalize the far right in the way the far left was internationalized in the 1960s and the 1970s. Whereas the international left was united with a common interest in ending, you know, European colonialism, U.S. imperialism, and putting an end to Cold War era politics. The Russia now is trying to unite the far right through Islamophobia. And if you look at far right protests in Europe and UK and Australia and the United States, you'll see anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-Muslim signs, anti-Muslim banners as a feature of these march and protests. It really has become, the glue which is uniting these far right groups across the planet.
What's the end result of this? If this happens, do you see it happening? And what's the end result when it happens, if it happens?
Well, I mean, the unimaginable or the unthinkable really is coming into view, as I point to in the piece. I mean, Russia is actively, funding far-right political parties and far-right political candidates all across Europe. It gave a $9 million loan, so to speak, if you can call it a loan, but 9 million euros, rather, to Marine Le Pen's National Front Party. Now she came within a whisker of winning the French general election last year. Now let's imagine a case where you have someone like Marine Le Pen who is openly Islamophobic, openly xenophobic, has borrowed and used the most heinous anti-Muslim tropes taken from the worst, the most nefarious types within the Islamophobia industry. If you have these governments come to power and then you have another major terrorist attack, which is carried out by a Muslim, then, you're going to see a raft and hosts of anti-Muslim legislation passed through these governments, whether that means ID badges, whether that means re-education camps like we already have in China, where up to 1 million Uyghur Muslims are going through these re-education camps and force them to denounce Islam and to force them to accept the communist atheist ideology. I mean, these things are within reach. Should these far-right political parties seize power in Western democratic states?
Talk to us about this article you did also on the neighboring state not too far from Russia, Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Bosnia is especially frightening. And it's interesting, I mean, more and more people become familiar with my work. More and more people reach out to me and ask me to cover the issues which they're concerned about. I would say, at the top of my head, in the last 6 to 12 months, I've had, a dozen or maybe a couple of dozen people from, you know, Bosnian Muslims reach out to me either via Twitter or via email, asking me to comment on the situation there. And so I've spent the last 6 months really doing a deep dive into the current situation. I mean, it's not a stretch to say that we, you know, we're on the eve or the verge of another Bosnian Muslim genocide. Now, at the risk of sounding, that might sound like hyperbole to some, but again, Russia is using the same paramilitary groups it used in the Ukraine, the Night Wolves bikie gang. The Serbian Republic within Bosnia Herzegovina. If you look at the leaders and the leader of that entity, that Bosnian Herzegovina entity, they're openly talking about separating and creating either their own Serbian state or joining Serbia itself. You're seeing a lot of anti-Muslim Islamophobic rhetoric which comes along with that, and Russia is there sowing discord, and not only sowing discord, but also arming Serbian paramilitary groups and also arming that Serbian entity within Bosnia and Herzegovina. So it's very frightening. Bosnian Muslims who live in the Bosnian Muslim enclave within the state are, you know, increasingly worried and are fearful that, you know, the darkest days of their history will, you know, be revisited upon them.
So do you feel now, is the evidence showing, is it that the Dayton Peace Agreement is something that could potentially just fold?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you've got, you know, hyper-nationalist or ultra-nationalist sentiments sweeping all across Europe. And so, you know, Republika Srpska has been no, you know, stranger to that either. So where you have hyper-nationalistic sentiment, where you have a will for people to separate and self-determine and create their own states, you know, at the expense of another minority or a neighboring state, then, you know, dangerous things usually follow. So, you know, the situation there is increasingly concerning.
Do you know of any other country that has, in its country, usually you have a prime minister, you have a president, one person that's in charge, but people don't know, it's kind of unique to Bosnia. You have three presidents running one country. How does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, you've got, you know, basically it's one nation state, but governed by three, basically, protectorates within those states or three, you know, entities. You've got the Croat entity, the Bosnian Muslim entity, and also the Serbian entity. So, you know, those, you know, the people within each of those states vote for their own particular leader, but at the end of the day, you really only have one state. Now, that's fine and dandy, and it's kind of worked for the last, you know, 25 years to a point. But the problem is now with the Serbian entity, Republika Srpska, being on the border of Serbia, it's, you know, Serbia has made no secret of the fact that they would like to claim that territory as their own, and also, you know, and thus why they're whipping up, you know, separatist sentiment within that enclave.
Is this really possible, CJ? Because so much money has been invested. You have the economy start. I mean, things are starting to pick up, you would think. People who visited from, who know the situation from the past, if they go there, it seems like everything has been rebuilt. The things are functioning. Is this really something that's possible to happen again?
Yeah, I mean, you know, unfortunately, you know, despite economic good times, you cannot prevent, you know, political entrepreneurs who will use separatist and ultra-nationalist rhetoric that demonizes a minority or a certain ethnic group, you know, for the purpose of mobilizing and seizing political power. And so, you know, in that republic, you do have that sentiment going, and people will, you know, and also states, act in a way which is not in their best interests, you know, for short-term political gain, at the cost of, you know, the well-being of the state going forward.
Is this something that the U.S. would have any control over or would allow, because the U.S. was there as the peacekeeping force? Would they allow something like this to happen?
Well, they certainly allowed the first genocide to take place in Bosnia and Herzegovina. You know, it took a long time before Clinton, you know, intervened there. In fact, European leaders turned their back on the genocide which was taking place because, you know, let's be honest, you know, Muslim lives don't matter, you know, in the corridors of European power. So they allowed the slaughter to take place. There was a long period of political inaction. Clinton's hand was forced eventually, and he eventually intervened. But we now, Donald Trump is not Bill Clinton, and we know how Donald Trump feels about Muslims and the Muslim world. He's completely indifferent, if not hostile, to that. He also, came into power on a supposed non-interventionist promise. And his political base really doesn't want him to engage in foreign military actions, despite the fact that he's carrying out military action all across the world right now. To be honest, I can't predict how Trump would react if another genocide was to take place there.
Wow, this is really sad to hear that after all this time that something like this can erupt again. And one last question on this topic. For the people that don't know, is it true that this was the greatest genocide that happened after World War II in Bosnia against Muslims there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, European Second Holocaust, or Europe's Second Holocaust, within the 20th century. Only, 40, 50 years after the Second World War. It's, those ill feelings, that communal and sectarian ill feeling remains in these states, but also it's been, fueled by these hyper-nationalist sentiments throughout the region.
One more. I'm sorry, because you mentioned Holocaust, and that's something, obviously, this sad, tragic event that happened, and it's talked about so much in the essence that it doesn't repeat again. Why don't you hear much about the Muslim Bosnian Holocaust that happened against Muslims so it doesn't repeat again?
Yeah, I mean, the words never again have rung hollow for a long time. We allow genocides to take place all across the world. I mean, what has the international community done to stop Myanmar's campaign of ethnic cleansing against, 1.2 million Rohingya Muslims? It's done nothing. What is the international community doing against China's effort to ethnically cleanse up to 12 million Uyghur Muslims at the moment? Nothing. I mean, not only is the world, and then you've got Rwanda and genocide, which certainly didn't have Muslims involved, but if you look at the track record of the international community stepping in to halt genocide where the majority of the population is Muslim, it hasn't been coming. We can also look at Syria. What has the international community done to halt, Assad's killing of and displacing of up to 12 million, mostly Sunni Muslims in Syria?
Speaking about, you mentioned China. Talk to us about some of the things like the GPS. You write about the G the you're bringing aware creating awareness about many things that are going on there. But for people who are ignorant to what is going on, there's many events unfolding. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly tragic what's happening in what was East Turkestan, in the far western region of what is mainland China. East Turkestan was actually its own nation state up until 1949. Then China invaded and occupied the region, has occupied that part of China. Well, what really isn't China has occupied East Turkestan ever since. Now, for a long period, the Chinese government left Uyghur Muslims in that region pretty much to their own. But things sort of changed in the 1980s, and China began a crackdown to snuff out any effort by Uyghur Muslims to recreate or to throw off the Chinese occupation. And then you had the war on terror, which the US war on terror, which started in 2001. And that gave China a veneer or a fig leaf to carry out what it called its own war on terror against Uyghur Muslims in East Turkestan, conflating Uyghur Muslim separatist ambitions or aspirations with Islamic terrorism. So that crackdown has been ever since has been really enforced, particularly in the last 10, the last decade. So much so that Uyghur Muslims now cannot exit China. Anybody who tried to exit China is arrested. I've interviewed a number of Uyghur Muslim refugees, one in Australia where his wife and child, they tried to join him after he attained his refugee status in Australia. When they arrived at the airport, she was detained. The 9-month-old baby was also arrested with her. Once the baby turns one under Chinese law, they will put her into prison for 5 years, and then they're going to sell the baby on the black market. Now, that's just one case of what's happening there, and the world is completely silent. Now, for other Uyghur Muslims, their cell phones are tracked. Their cars are located with GPS tracking devices. If they want to move out of East Turkestan and maybe go to Beijing or Shanghai, then they have to seek a special permit to do so. They're forced into re-education camps force them to denounce Islam. Those who do not denounce Islam and then put into either hard labor camps or in prison for up to 5 to 10 years. Even Uyghur Muslim families are forced to have a Chinese communist representative in their home for Chinese nationalist holidays as part of indoctrinating them to the Chinese state ideology.
Now, are women also being, I mean, this is what would you say a modern day Inquisition sounds like?
Yeah, it really is that. I wrote a story recently on he's a Hui Muslim living in the United States. His wife was detained, arrested, forced conversion, and then in prison she was tortured, and where she eventually died. And he's actually trying to sue the Chinese government. He's told me that he's already had two assassination attempts on his life. One time when he returned to China in an effort to sue the Chinese government for the death of his wife, and another time in the US, which he has reported to the FBI. When I asked him for details of how they tried to carry out these assassination attempts, and he said that the Chinese government are very good, particularly their intelligence agencies, at making a traffic accident or making an assassination look like a traffic accident. He believes that two attempts on his life were done in that manner.
I heard women are being forced, not only, as you said, forced conversions, but what to leave Islam. I heard that they're also being forced to marry certain to have forced marriages to what is it, Communist Party members?
Yeah, it's, you have to, you have communists have to, some people who were Chinese who subscribe to the communist and atheist ideology. There has been stories of forced marriages. To the extent that that's happening, I'm not exactly sure. I can't give you the numbers, but I have heard anecdotal accounts of that happening. But I mean, families are being separated all the time. I mean, even now, the police, Chinese police in that province, have these new smart glasses. So they wear these glasses, which are pick up facial recognition, identify facial recognition that feeds back into a database, and they can identify a Uyghur Muslim on a train, on a bus, on a plane, even walking in the street. And if that Uyghur Muslim is wanted for any reason, it could be a parking violation, then it just gives them an excuse to make the arrest, force them to a re-education camp, and then they're processed accordingly.
Wow, this is just so amazing to hear. It's so incredible. You can't wrap your mind. People are sitting at home here and enjoying many of the things that we have. We're not thinking about outside of the box what's going on in the rest of the world. But this is in our day and age, this is actually happening. What can people do? What can people who are who have a heart, they want to make a change. What can someone do to speak out against this? What do you suggest?
Yeah, I mean it's very frustrating because I mean even what's interesting is not one single Muslim leader of a Muslim majority nation state has offered one word of condemnation of what China is doing against the Uyghur Muslim population. And that's for a very simple reason, is China's economic power is so vast and so strong that so many nation states have become interdependent or dependent on the Chinese economy. And they fear that by speaking out and denouncing what China is doing in East Turkestan will result in economic punishment, a loss of trade, a loss of foreign or Chinese investment in their states. So the international community at the nation state level is completely frozen on the Uyghur Muslim issue. And it's what's really only left to activists. The only people who are making noise about this are actually Uyghur Muslim refugees who have been fortunate enough to escape China.
Tell
Then,
us.
sorry, to get back to your question, what can we do is, yeah, is just make as much noise as possible. So, I speak to Muslims on a daily basis who are completely unfamiliar, with what is happening in East Turkestan. So, yeah, I encourage people to make noise on social media. The more noise, and that gets the ball rolling, and and hopefully creating a climate where political action can follow.
Yes, absolutely. Tell us about this new sport that you talk about, where Palestinians are being killed as a sport.
I wrote a piece in the New Arab a couple of months ago on this. I mean, I've been to the West Bank and Gaza, West Bank and Israel a number of times, Gaza just the one time. But and other journalists have documented this over the years that Israel does shoot Palestinians for sport. I mean, I haven't witnessed myself, but Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He was in a refugee camp in Gaza about 15 years ago, and he saw Israeli soldiers play what they call a game of cat and mouse. So they go to these refugee camps, they set up in their jeeps, and over a loudspeaker, they will, say, your mums are whores, we're going to rape your mother, stuff like this, to entice Palestinian kids to come out and start throwing rocks at their jeeps or their tanks. When Palestinian kids do that, then they return with live fire. And he witnessed Palestinian boys being killed. And Chris Hedges told me this story himself, and when I had him on my own podcast, I haven't witnessed that, but the videos that we've seen out of, coming out of Gaza since the Great Return March, began, several months ago. I mean, I posted a video yesterday of a Palestinian, young man pushing a wheel through what is, the within Gaza, within inside the Gaza perimeter, and was picked off by an Israeli sniper. We've seen videotape emerge of Israeli snipers high-fiving and celebrating every time they shoot an unarmed Palestinian journalist or a Palestinian medic or a Palestinian kid or a Palestinian woman. And not only that, we also know, also from the 2014 siege of Gaza, there's a hill just outside of Sadara, which is just beyond Gaza itself. This small rising hill is an ideal location where, people can pull up a car and watch from the safety of this hill as Israel uses live fire against Palestinian protesters, and also as Israeli warplanes drop their ordnance on Gaza. It's a real, it's one of the sickest and most depraved things that you'll ever witness in your life. But killing Palestinians has become a form of almost entertainment for even the Israeli military, and also the most hardened far right supporters of the Israeli government.
And this is another thing that you advise people to create awareness, to make noise about.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of noise made about the Palestinian cause for, decades now, and it doesn't seem to have made much of a difference. And that's because the United States is, Israel's number one protector. I mean, if you took away the United States, and all sorts of veto and sanctions actions would have been enforced against Israel at the United Nations. Because the U.S. has that veto power, being one of the five members of the permanent, one of the permanent members of the Security Council, action has been stymied and blocked. Now, political winds are changing in the United States. Whereas the Democratic Party was in unison in their support for Israel, that is breaking away. You now have a fissure within the Democratic Party where you have the old stalwarts like the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's, established Democrats who have been around for a long time. While they still openly support Israel, it's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and younger Democratic voters, particularly millennials, are breaking away from Israel and are denouncing Israel's occupation. So what you're going to see in this country in the next 5 to 10 years is where the Democratic Party is openly condemns and opposes Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. And when we get to that point, and you have a democratic government back in power, you'll see action against Israel. I mean, Obama made action against Israel right in the very last few months of his when he denounced the occupation at the UN through the US Ambassador Suzanne Rice. So, we're going to see a stripping away of that support. You're going to see Israel become a wedge issue in at the national political level. And once that happens, really, the days of Israel's occupation are numbered.
What about India? The genocide alert in India. Can you bring us up to speed on what's going on over there?
Yeah, I mean, it's what's happening in India. It really is. I tweeted that out, you know, recently. As a genocide alert, you have members of India's ruling party, the BJP, openly advocating the killing of Muslims. They, if they're not feting or celebrating those who you know, Hindu mobs who carry out lynchings and murders of Muslims. You know, some will go out and endorse it. Some will say nothing. But you know, almost no Indian political, no figures within India's ruling government, within ruling party of the government, condemns these attacks. We've seen a spike of, you know, lynchings are happening now on a daily basis. In the province, in the northwestern part of India, you have the province Assam, where India have effectively wiped off 4 million Muslims off their voter rolls or citizenship claims, depriving them of citizenship claims. And you've also had members of India's ruling party saying now if they don't leave and go back into Bangladesh, I mean, but his families have been there for 50, 70, 100 years. If they don't return to Bangladesh, when Bangladesh didn't exist back in that time, then they'll be shot and killed. You know, so India's, you also, within India's ruling party, you have what is called the RSS, which is the world's largest non-governmental organization. And that organization is about, you know, 1.5 million strong, and it provides the political DNA to India's ruling party. And within that, their rhetoric is their ambition is to turn India exclusively into a Hindu fascist state where there's no room for Sikhs, Muslims, Dalits, Christians, etc. A
couple more questions. CJ, can you tell us, you've just done a piece also on the coercion of Muslims, turning them into spies here in the U.S. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been documented reasonably well up until now that there's been instances of the FBI coercing Muslim Americans or Muslim immigrants into becoming or to spying, trying to convince them to spy on Muslim communities, turning them into government paid informants. What hasn't been known until now is the extent and breadth of this effort. I mean, every single day, the FBI is walking up to, you know, knocking on the doorstep of Muslim-owned businesses, Muslim-owned homes, Muslim leased properties, and asking whether Muslims are prepared or willing to spy on their friends, their family, their neighbors, their communities. And more important, more specifically, it's without a target given. So this is a part of a mass surveillance program. Now, when a Muslim rejects the offer, which in one of the cases I reported in my piece, Mr. Tanvir, he worked at a 99 cent store in New Jersey. Now, FBI agents turned up to his place of business and asked him to, you know, become an informant. He declined. He said that would go against the principles of his religious faith to spy on his, you know, fellow Muslim citizens. When he declined, they became increasingly aggressive towards him. They returned, threatening him that they would change either his visa status or his residency status or that of his family members. Nothing happened. He left it at that, and he didn't hear back from him for several months. Then he tried to board a flight to Pakistan to visit his unwell mother there. When he boarded the flight, U.S. immigration refused denied him to board that flight. He left the airport. He called the FBI and said, why have I been put onto a no-fly list? Why was I denied the boarding that flight? And they said, well, we'll put you on a no-fly list until you agree to spy on Muslim communities. And I also interview a guy called Nabil Mouad, who was a Moroccan national. He actually represented the Moroccan junior development squad when he was a teenager, came to the United States when he was 17 on a student visa, and then applied for a position on the University of Florida's soccer team. He gave the coach his scouting tape, which that's the only copy he had. It was on VHS. That was his pride and joy. His whole life is basically this videotape. He went to return several weeks later to pick up his tape and also ask the coach how, you know, what he thought of his scouting tape, etc. The coach explained that the tape had gone missing and they'd lost it. And he gave him a chance to look for the tape, came back several days later, and they basically shrugged their shoulders and said they didn't know what the tape was. He obviously, in a moment of fit and rage, he threatened to assault his soccer coach for losing, you know, his most important possession in life, and he was reported to the FBI. Now, you know, as I said in the piece, if he weren't a Muslim, that story would have stopped and started there. A young man distressed by the fact that he'd lost something that was valuable to him, an argument ensued, and that would have been the end of the story. But because he was Muslim, he was reported to the FBI. He was arrested on terrorism charges. He was in prison for, I believe, about 3 months, kept in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day, denied. They would refuse to tell him which direction Mecca was. They refused to allow him access to a Quran. And then periodically, he believes, you know, at least once a week while he was in prison, either an agent from the FBI or Department of Homeland Security visit him, trying to coerce him into becoming an informant, and promising he'd be released and have his visa status upgraded. He, like Tanvir, the early example I gave, denied their request and said that would run counter to his faith. And so they said that he'd be deported. And sure enough, 6 weeks later, he was put on a plane and sent back to Morocco, where he is today.
Last time I spoke, I believe I understood that you were studying extensively this area of terrorism, and do you see Muslims as being a national security threat? That Muslims are, Islam is producing the most terrorism, or Muslims are to be feared? That there is a growing threat of Muslims in the United States? Is this fact or fiction?
It's total fiction, and everybody in counterterrorism circles knows this. But there's a difference between what, you know, we in the terrorism academic world subscribe and what actual politicians put in place. There's always a disconnect between, you know, policy and politics. So, you know, it plays well politically right now to demonize Muslims and to put policies in place which target and discriminate against Muslim communities. Unfortunately, you have the Islamophobia industry, which has crept into, you know, law enforcement agencies like the FBI. We know for a fact that several members of the Islamophobia industry have actually given presentations on Islam to FBI agents. And in their presentations, they, you know, will erroneously claim that Islam is a gateway to terrorism, that there is something in the Islamic text and scripture which promotes violent extremism, which clearly it does not. So when FBI agents leave these training consultations with that kind of belief that basically says that Islam is a gateway to terrorism, then they'll begin viewing every Muslim as a potential terrorist. And our counterterrorism policies that are currently in place do kind of subscribe to that belief, which is why we have mass surveillance against Muslim communities and why law enforcement agencies are trying so hard to recruit Muslim informants to spy on these communities.
How can this have gotten so far based on a lie? I mean, this is factually incorrect. The statistics don't show it. It's totally false. You said it's fiction. How could
you will not find a single person? I mean, I have an undergraduate degree in terrorism. I'm doing a postgraduate degree in counterterrorism. You will not find a single individual within the terrorism academic discipline who believes Islam has any relationship with terrorism whatsoever. But we academics aren't in charge of policy, and we're certainly not politicians. So this is happening. Because we do have, you know, the Fox News effect, which whips up, fear of Muslims. We have Donald Trump, who leveraged fear of Muslims and Islamophobia to come into office. I mean, his very first act as a politician was to smear America's first black president as either a Muslim or as foreign born. So, you know, people have been, whipped up into fear because of the Islamophobia industry, because of political opportunists and entrepreneurs like Donald Trump. To believe that there's something inherently violent in Islam, and it is turning Muslims into terrorists. And that's why we have these policy prescriptions which are in place at the moment, even though it is not only counterproductive, but, you know, patently false. In fact, since 9/11, terrorist attacks carried out by right-wing extremists have outnumbered terrorist attacks carried out by Muslims on a scale of 3 to 1. But nobody is calling for the profiling of Trump supporters. We are, the FBI is not trying to, recruit Trump supporters as informants to spy on other Trump supporters.
So you, as a terrorist expert, would you say that Sharia or Muslims are the greatest threat, as we hear expounded many of times, to our freedoms here in America? If not, what is?
Well, I mean, what is the greatest threat to our freedoms right now? It's certainly not Islam. It's hyper-nationalism. I mean, America, all of the Western world is being swept up by hyper-nationalism. We're returning to, the type of atmospherics that we had on the eve of the Second World War. Whereas you had the end of the Cold War, and there was a look outward. There was, I remember when the Cold War ended, and we thought, right, that's the end of the nation state. We're all beginning to become one global community, global citizens with a global outreach, a cosmopolitan type of look. With Europe, you had the breakaway. I mean, in the Cold War, to get from one European state to the next, you had to pull out papers and go from one, border checkpoint to the next. Now all those borders melt away, and we thought that really was how the world was going to look going forward. But now we have a return to borders and walls, and defining who we are, who they are, and this us and them mentality, where we identify the foreign other as an ex, as a threat to our internal security. And the reason this is happening is because of, economic malaise that's happening around the world. Whereas we had a healthy middle class in the 1960s and the 1970s, and at some point in the 1980s, neoliberal economics, which was started by Reagan and Thatcher, which was built around the ideology of destroying the welfare state, creating a militaristic state, which has gutted out the middle class, where we have income inequality on a scale we've never seen before, where we have a Western world which is divided between haves and have-nots. Well, the have-nots have been told the reason for their plight is not, corporate, the overreach of corporate influence in our political discourse, which is giving corporations and the rich everything they want at the expense of us. But we've been told that the reason for economic malaise and the reason that we're falling out of the middle class into economic poverty is because of foreigners and immigrants and Muslims. And this is creating, sympathies towards ultra-nationalist far-right movements and political figures.
Okay, last thing. There's a lot of sad news here, but good information that we can go ahead and important information that we can help to get out there. So hopefully we can awaken some good hearts and some noise can be made, some awareness. And I think our friend Joe Rogan has a great platform. I know you've been on the Joe Rogan show before. Are there any plans to return? Has he invited you back? I mean, he's someone that can help to spread some of this good information out there. What do you think?
He can. And I mean, his audience is mostly center right and far right. He sympathizes with Islamophobes. He's a close friend of someone like Sam Harris. He's a close friend with and his name eludes me. It'll come to me in a second. But he's a number of he hangs out with these Islamophobes. He sympathizes with Islamophobic rhetoric. He brings them on. He never challenges them about their beliefs as far as Islam being a threat to Western democratic values. He subscribes to that kind of thinking. So to be honest, I don't think he's really interested in hearing a counter viewpoint or people that challenge, those erroneous beliefs. I think he's made his mind up on Islam and Muslims, and that's that.
Did you see yourself kind of there? Were you there in that same pocket being influenced by the same people? You came out from that. Do you think there's hope that possibly he can also?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I came out. I went into Islamophobia, but from a different point of view, though. I mean, I was never an Islamophobe, and then, I mean, I became an Islamophobe while living in the world's most populous Muslim country, Indonesia. I lived there for a decade, and I was fine with Islam, and I was fine with Muslims. A lot of close friends who are Muslims, but then I witnessed an Al-Qaeda terrorist attack, or more specifically, Jamar Islamiyah, in 2005. on Jimbaran Beach, where about a dozen people were killed. And basically, my friends and I were effectively first responders. We had to run down the beach and, either determine who was alive, who was dead, and bring the wounded from the beach up into nearby roadway. Now, that turned me into an Islamophobe because I became obsessed with what happened that night. Obviously, because I'd done a double degree in, on my way to attaining a double degree in terrorism. That short period of my life from 2005 to about 2009, I did subscribe to the type of bigoted beliefs which were espoused by Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and the like, and Christopher Hitchens. But then when I pulled myself out of it by researching Islam, and I did that on my own because I wrote a book on the Quran and I wrote a book about the life of the Prophet Muhammad, it was only when I did a research of his life did I understand how Islamophobes and Islamic extremists like bin Laden or Baghdadi decontextualize the Quran in a way which is totally inconsistent with what Muhammad meant. And you can only understand what the Prophet Muhammad meant when you understand his biography and his life and where he was at any given point in his life. So, it was Islam which, a terrorist attack which turned me into an Islamophobe, and it was Islam which brought me out of it.
Joe Rogan, right now, we'll get him this direct message, God willing. And now you're sitting across from which guest can you picture in your mind on the Joe Rogan show? If he when he hears this, to set it up, who would it be?
It could be any host of him. I mean, there's so many now. I mean, he's had, any number of guests he's had on before, I'd be happy to sit across.
You're ready to go. You get the call. You're ready to come back on and challenge some of those falsehoods.
Yeah. There's Sam Harris, there's Richard Dawkins.
Doesn't matter. Anyone he picks.
Okay, call it Sam Harris, fine.
Okay. CJ, we appreciate the wonderful work you're doing. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
How can people now, if they want to follow some of your work, you have a podcast also, please tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. The best way to follow me is on Twitter at CJ Werleman. That's CJ Werleman. And I have a podcast called, which is Channel the Rage. You can find that on iTunes. We've now done about 54, 55 episodes. The whole purpose of the podcast is to give a voice to the voiceless, or rather Muslim victims of the global war on terror and discrimination. We have guests who can dial in from Muslims from India, Muslims from Myanmar, Muslims from, Uyghur Muslim refugees. We've had a number of those guys on. It's trying to reveal what's happening around the world, stories about Muslims that, Western media refuses to tell.
Keep speaking truth. Thank you very much. It's very nice and honor to have you back on the program. God willing, we'll meet again soon sometime.
For sure, mate. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, CJ, for being with us here on The Dean Show. We really appreciate you speaking the truth and being out there on the forefront, creating awareness. And we just got to hear some very sad news. It reminds us that holding on to this deen will be like holding on to the hot coals, as it's been stated. And you see that the people who have been made to look like those who are causing terrorism, havoc on the lands, are the people who are the most oppressed, the Muslims. And as CJ Werleman confirmed, in academic circles, counter-terrorist academics all confirm there's nobody in this area of expertise that will come out and say that Islam is the cause of terrorism. Muslims are the growing threat to this country. This is, as he said, this is fiction. This is false. But you do have a true narrative that's out there. People who are trying to create dissension through fear, through your ignorance. So make sure that you get informed on what Islam is, what Muslims are all about here at The Dean Show. Send us your questions. We have a live chat box. We have a phone number, 1-800-662-ISLAM. In this day and age of misinformation, you got to be careful what you're looking for. you know they'll attack you. You go out there looking for hate, you're going to find it. And then those cookies that they have, they're going to keep sending you more and more. But you have to make a commitment within yourself. I want to know the truth. I'm going to be what? Genuine and sincere in that quest for the truth. Because the truth shall set you free. And it's out there. But if you're already angry and you're bitter, you're not happy in life, and you go down that path of seeking misinformation and following people out there who are spreading misinformation, it's not going to help you feel any better. So be genuine, be sincere in your quest to want to know the truth. We're here to help you. Call us, visit us, subscribe to The Dean Show. Click on the notifications tab so you can be informed when our next show comes out. And we hope that you make that genuine attempt to learn really what Islam is about, what Muslims are about. Keep visiting us. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time here on The Dean Show. Peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.
Please subscribe to The Dean Show. Follow us on our official Facebook and Twitter pages in the links below. Please also help support The Dean Show by making a donation in the link below.